Good evening, all. I'm Don Rakow, the Elizabeth Newman Wilds Director of Cornell Plantations, and we're very happy to see you all on this robust fall evening. We have a great lecture tonight, and in a moment I will be asking the speaker's introducer to come up. But before I do that, I just want to mention a couple of things. First, I'm sure many of you have noticed our new Brian C. Nevin Welcome Center, and we've received many compliments on its design and many questions about when it is actually opening. We are hoping to open the building by year's end, or certainly by the very beginning of the new year, and once it is open, it will be regularly staffed, and both the gift shop and small cafe will be in operation. So be looking in the local media for the date for the opening of that. Also, we, as I've mentioned in previous weeks, we've developed a wonderful partnership with the Statler and with Banfi's, in which anyone having dinner on the evening of one of the plantation's lectures can get a free appetizer with their dinner. So if you did not pick up one of those cards entitling you to the free appetizer, see one of us afterwards. Finally, I do want to announce that we have two more lectures in the series after tonight, so two more opportunities to take advantage of those free appetizers. And we have two wonderful speakers who will be coming in, Peter Del Tredici from the Arnold Arboretum, talking about wild urban plants, and then Lee Stetson as John Muir, talking about John Muir and his legacy. So at this point, I would like to ask David Weinstein, Senior Research Associate in the Department of Natural Resources, to come up to the podium and introduce his colleague and tonight's speaker. David.
I've had the great fortune to work alongside Dr. Tim Fahey in the Department of Natural Resources for about 30 years now. Tim came to Dartmouth College about a year after I did, back in the 70s. And then in the early 80s, he came to Cornell about a year after I did. Now, I don't want to imply that metaphysically I was somehow, or he was waiting for me to somehow prepare the ground for him. I think Tim has done pretty well on his own. Yeah, he hasn't really needed any help to become a wonderful scientist. He's a full professor in the Department of Natural Resources here at Cornell. He has been appointed the Liberty Hyde Bailey Professor of Natural Science, as well as a Stephen H. Weiss Presidential Fellow. He is well known throughout the university as a great, great teacher. He received the SUNY Chancellor Award for Excellence in Teaching, but beyond that, it's the response that his students have had to him. He has been the recipient of adoring admiration by countless students who literally stampede to his classes to try and get in. They're well known to be wonderful experiences. Of course, his teaching style is a little bit offbeat. There was one of his graduate students a few years ago at his PhD thesis defense made the statement that, as far as he could remember, Tim never answered one question that he had put to Tim during the entire time of his graduate career. And that's clearly not because Tim doesn't know anything and couldn't really tell this student any answers. It's just that his style was to focus on making sure that the students around him got the tools to be able to answer their own questions. And he has made a huge number of students so much better as scientists and as people because his focus was giving them this toolbox. For the rest of us, he has, in fact, answered a great, great many fascinating questions. He has been one of the leaders of what has really been a groundbreaking set of experiments that have run over decades at a place called the Hubbard Brook Experimental Forest, in which he and his colleagues have contributed to putting words about major societal issues into the lexicon of all of us. Things like acid rain, the effects of clear cutting of forests on those forests, the use of monitoring the cycling of nutrients through forests as a measure of how healthy those forests are remaining. And more recently, he has chaired a committee here at Cornell, which established the plan that Cornell is going to follow to make the campus carbon neutral and essentially making Cornell able to do its part to contribute to reducing the global warming effects that are now experiencing. More recently, he has turned his attention out here at the Arnott Forest nearby to Ithaca to earthworms. And we're going to hear a lot about earthworms tonight. With those of us who grew up hearing about earthworms never could imagine that they weren't anything other than a great addition to any environment that they would be in. But through Tim and his students, he's helped open up a window on helping us to see there's a different way of looking at earthworms, and they may have quite a nefarious side to them. But we'll hear more about that later. Those are really just the facts about Tim, but much more important, I want to tell you about the passion with which he observes and dissects phenomena in natural ecosystems to help himself and all of us understand what's really making those systems tick. Not long ago, I heard Tim say that out of anything that he could possibly do, what he really most wanted to do was to be able to spend his time hiking the trails throughout this country. Coming from somebody else, particularly in academia, you might think, oh, this person just has had it with the rigors of academia, and they just want to run someplace to be able to shut off their mind. That's not Tim. Tim spent a number of years ago, he spent the summer hiking the Appalachian Trail with his son, and he came back full of observations about what was happening in the forests of the eastern United States, what was making them tick, and what kind of systems he saw earthworms invading into, and which ones somehow were resisting the invasion of earthworms. And then this past summer, he spent the summer hiking with his daughter out in the West, hiking the Pacific Crest Trail as well as other trails. Now, I haven't heard his observations yet. I haven't really debriefed him fully about whether he saw earthworms starting to invade across the Mississippi River and out into the West. But maybe we'll hear something about what he thinks about that stuff tonight. Really, I can't wait to hear what new layers of natural ecosystems he's been able to peel off and to tell us new stories about what's happening out there in the natural world. So without further delay, here's Dr. Tim Fahey talking about earthworms in the forest. Blessings or curse?
You David really lays it on thick, doesn't he? I wanted to start with a, if you'll permit me, with a boyhood reminiscence. That's not me. Not an actual photo. But I can, you know, a lot of us when we were kids, I grew up in the Boston suburbs, and like most kids, there were ponds around, and we would go fishing in the ponds, put the worm on the hook and catch the sunfish from the ponds. I was never much of a fisherman, but I can still remember that there weren't any bait machines in those days. You had to go out and dig the worms out of the woods. And I can still remember that my brothers would show me where you could go to dig the earthworms. And it always seemed kind of odd to me that you couldn't just dig them anywhere. There were only certain places where you'd find earthworms. Most places, if you went out in the woods and dug a hole, there would be no earthworms there. But there were these particular secret spots that you could go and dig earthworms. And I don't think they really cared much about the fact that that was kind of odd, but it really grated on me. Why is it that you can find earthworms here and not earthworms over there? So ecology is defined as one of the best statements of the objective of ecology is trying to understand what controls the distribution and abundance of species. And so I think it was ingrained in me, and I can still, you know, 30 years later, think back to being bothered by the fact that there were earthworms here and there weren't earthworms over here, and why was that? And what I didn't know at the time was that these earthworms that we were digging out of the woods weren't native species, as David mentioned. So these are all European earthworms. So the title of the talk was Blessing or Curse. I think probably most of you know what the answer is going to be, right? Earthworms in the forest, blessing or curse. We're probably going to conclude, like most environmentalists, that this is a curse. But as a gardener, what's your feeling about earthworms? Good or bad? Good, right? Good. If you have earthworms in your garden, you're very happy about it. It means that you have a good garden, or the worms make the garden good. Not quite clear which way it works. What do they do? What do the earthworms do for the garden? Well, they aerate the soil, yeah, so it would get compacted unless the earthworms were there mixing the soil up. Anything else? Yeah, so they break down. So if you leave the, you know, if you leave the mulch on the soil, they mix the mulch into the soil. They make humus. You kind of think of them as promoting the tilth of the soil. So it's hard to know though whether earthworms are the cause of good soil or the good soil is the cause of having the earthworms in your garden. Darwin wrote a lot about earthworms. In fact, he had a whole book about earthworms, which in its early days sold a lot more than the other book that you wrote, which I... Vegetable Mold and Earthworms by Charles Darwin. And this is a quote directly out of this book. In the history of the world, than these lowly organized creatures. So obviously earthworms have been of benefit. I don't think he's saying that they ruined the world, but that they benefited the world. They made it possible to grow a lot of food, perhaps, is what he was thinking about here. And what do they do? So another reminiscence. 20-plus years ago, I spent a sabbatical leave in northwestern England at a research station called the Institute of Terrestrial Ecology. And I was studying roots of trees. And I was working in some woodlands there. And to study roots, you have to dig holes in the ground. And it was a woodland that had been studied by a lot of the people at this institute. And I was digging holes in the ground, and about this far down in the ground, I kept coming across some sort of a net, sort of the kind of netting that you put fruit in, some sort of a mesh. And it was about this far down in the ground. And I went back to the research station, and the guy said, "Oh, that must have been old John Satchel." Who wrote a book, Earthworm Ecology from Darwin to Vermiculture. And he had been at Institute of Terrestrial Ecology and had been studying in this woods about 10 years before I came there. And what he did was to put this mesh on the ground, and then he was going to come back. He retired a couple of years. He retired in 83. 10 years later, I was back there and digging through the ground, and here's this mesh 6 inches down in the ground. What had happened? The earthworms had moved 6 inches of soil over that mesh. So this is a profound effect on the soil, is moving that much soil. Darwin tried to make similar kinds of calculations. He didn't have mesh at the time, but his calculations were a little different than what you would get from that calculation. But a lot of dirt being moved by earthworms. So earthworms move soil, they aerate the soil, they're involved in vermiculture. So why should they be a curse? And what about Darwin's opinion? How can somebody think it would be a curse? Just a little bit about the classification of earthworms. So they're in a group called the oligocates, the phylum Annelidus, which is a big phylum. There's about 6,000 species of these large creatures, the earthworms, worldwide. There's about a dozen or so that we would consider invasive species in the northern United States. There are no large native earthworms in the northern part of the United States or in Canada, adjacent Canada. And the standard story for why this is the case is that the glaciers came down, went down into northern Pennsylvania, and any earthworms that could have been were here were forced way to the south. You do find earthworms down in southern United States, but no earthworms here, and that they've never come back. I don't know if that's entirely true, but that's the standard story about it. So if you see an earthworm in your garden, or you see an earthworm out in the forest around here, you can be sure it's a European or now some Asian species of earthworm, an exotic earthworm. Mostly they're European earthworms, like the most common one is the common nightcrawler, which is a big earthworm you see in your garden all the time, right? Probably people have dug up their garden and chopped it in half, a Lumbricus terrestris. invasive species. So about a dozen of these earthworms are considered invasive species, regarded as invasive species. Now, an invasive species now has an official government definition, as defined by executive order number 13112 to the EPA from the Clinton administration back about 10 years ago, 12 years ago, said that this is what an invasive species is. It's a non-native species that causes some harm. It's a bit controversial, as you can imagine, because what actually defines harm? I mean, there could be some, in economic terms, I mean, you could kind of think of, if you have this exotic species and it causes more economic harm, loss, than it does benefit, then you could call it an invasive species. Or if it harms human health, pretty obvious that it would be well-defined. Environmental harm is a little trickier. How would you decide whether an invasive species was causing environmental harm, net environmental harm? I mean, they must have some benefit. Darwin thought they were the most important thing that ever happened in the world. we're not too concerned with exotic species that get into human systems. So, you know, nobody's too concerned about the fact that there's exotic species in the vermiculture system. When we get worried about their environmental harm is when they get out into natural systems, natural ecosystems. So how's this? Would it be a safe conclusion or a safe supposition that an exotic species is likely to be causing environmental harm because the system developed, the organisms developed their traits in the absence, they evolved their traits in the absence of that species. And so if you put this new species into the system, these organisms have never experienced that species, and so they're likely not to be able to deal with the species in a normal way anymore. Gets a little tricky, though, because the earthworms were probably here 2 million years ago, before the glaciation, and the trees had already evolved most of their traits 2 million years ago. So, and the species that live with earthworms in Europe, the tree species that live with earthworms in Europe are very, very closely related. They have almost exactly the same traits. It's a pretty tricky issue to say that this is causing harm. What would Harry Shaw say? I didn't come to Harry Shaw's talk, but he was talking about naturalness and nature in a place like England where there's no such thing, right? So would the invasion of American earthworms into Europe be causing harm? Would it be changing nature around? Well, at least we could maybe develop. So this is supposed to be a science talk. So we've got to have some scientific evidence about harm, about what earthworms could be doing to the forest. First, a little bit more about what they do in our northern forest. Most simply, what they do is they mix the soil 6 inches in 10 years. They're moving a lot of soil around. Now, in order to understand the argument about the effects of earthworms on native forests, you have to understand the profile, the soil profile of the typical northern forest in the absence of earthworms. In our cold environments, without earthworms, soils develop a thick duff layer on the surface, what's called a forest floor. A lot of humus develops. And the thickness of this organic horizon, you can see it there, it's decaying leaves, it's sticks and branches that are partially decayed. It's the humus that lies on the surface of the soil. Maybe 4 inches thick, maybe 2 inches thick, depending on what kind of trees you have or what kind of soil you have. And what this organic horizon on the surface does for the forest is recycles the nutrients. So the nutrients that are in the leaves and in the sticks get broken down by fungi and other organisms in the soil and made available for the trees to take up. So there's a cycling of nutrients through that organic horizon, which you see on the surface there. I'm not sure if I have a pointer here. Yeah. So this is the organic horizon in this forest. It's about 3 inches thick. And it's just packed densely with tree roots, tiny little tree roots that are there to quickly take up the nutrients before they get out of the system, recycling the nutrients. And what the earthworms do is to incorporate all that organic matter into the soil. So they eat the litter, and they eat the humus, and they mix it down into the mineral soil, so that after 5 or 10 years of earthworm invasion, the mineral soil is right at the surface. There's no humus anymore. There's a lot of organic matter in the mineral soil, but there's no humus anymore. And so the forest has this year's leaves on the ground, the leaf litter that's fallen down, but that on the surface there is just the mineral soil, no organic horizon. And so if you go out into a farm woodlot around here, this is what you see. There's no organic horizon. And the reason for that is because there are earthworms in that forest. Now, could this possibly have some negative consequences? So here's a profile that's been invaded by earthworms. There's a few leaves on the surface, but the organic matter has been mixed down into the mineral soil. It's changed around fundamentally the way the system works, because the way that organic horizon works is fundamental to the way the forest soil acts as a recycling mechanism for the system. This is the common nightcrawler, as I mentioned earlier. Earthworm biologist, and I have to warn you, I'm not an earthworm biologist. I only came by this a few years ago when I realized that my study sites had been invaded by earthworms. I'm a forest person. I study roots. But they classify earthworms according to their feeding habits. This is Lumbricus terrestris, the common nightcrawler, which is defined as or classified as an anisic species. What an anisic species of worm does, and Lumbricus terrestris is the type of this species, this category, is to build a deep burrow in the soil. So they drill a hole in the ground and dig a permanent burrow down as much as a foot, foot and a half down into the ground and pull soil up to the surface. They drag the leaves down into their burrow. They create, and you'll see this if you go out to the woods around here, they create these piles of middens, which are remains of leaf litter that they're eating. If you go to a typical forest, say go to, this is actually taken in McGowan Woodlot over by Turkey Hill Road, you see these piles of earthworm middens. So these are Lumbricus terrestris middens. They've kind of covered up their burrow so that they can control the temperature and moisture in their burrow. And the surface of the soil is casts of those earthworms. That is, it's passed through the gut of the earthworm and been deposited there. That's that 6 inches of soil that's accumulated. So the same thing has happened in McGowan Woodlot. This is all earthworm poop. Not all the species dig deep burrows. This is probably the most common earthworm that we find in most of the forests around here. It's a red worm called Lumbricus rubellus, and it's an epigeic species. So instead of digging a deep burrow down a foot and a half into the ground, it just feeds right near the surface, goes down maybe 3 or 4 inches into the ground. It does the same thing in that it eliminates that organic horizon. They're very voracious. They're also quite big. This is a fishing, this is the kind of worm you get from a bait machine called red worm for bass fishing. And that's probably one of the principal sources of these worms that are getting out into the woods now. That's an epigeic species. I'll talk a little bit more about Lumbricus rubellus as we go through here. And then there are also some species that spend all their time down below ground, in the soil itself. These are endo, deep-geic species. So octolasian is a typical one around here. Gray worms, they're not pigmented because they're never exposed to the sun. And they feed down on whatever they can get down deep in the ground. Usually, it seems curious to me, and I don't think this has been well explained, usually if you find Lumbricus rubellus in the forest, you also find octolasian, you also find Aporectidea, and you often find Lumbricus terrestris. Often you'll find 5 or 6 different species. They're all invasive species. They're all European earthworms, and they all got to the same place at the same time. And whether they actually work together as some sort of a consortium to, you know, to operate as a team in the soil hasn't been well established. But it is does seem like kind of a coincidence that they all invaded into the same place at the same time. Somebody will sort that out eventually. Now, I'm going to put up a conceptual diagram for earthworm invasion. And I realized when I was looking through my slides that this is at about 7:48, and people are settling back in their seats. And they're going to look at this diagram, and that's it. Gone. You know, I get some advice on teaching early on in my career from experienced teachers. And one thing they always said was, you have to throw in the 20-minute zinger. So 20 for the students. 20 minutes into the lecture, you've pretty much lost everybody, right? So you have to throw something in there that's going to get them back awake. So what do I put in this conceptual diagram? So I got to come up with a zinger. So I was walking over and I said, what do I got for a zinger? Oh, so kids always, little abused kids say, nobody likes me, everybody hates me, I guess I'll go eat worms. Is that how it goes? Or I think I'll just eat worms, something like that. So as far as Zinger goes, don't let your kids eat worms. I was telling Dr. Claypack, he said he has a picture of his daughter with a handful of worms. Don't eat worms, because some earthworms contain a pathogenic organism that can kill people. So kids have died from eating worms, so don't eat worms. So anyway, back to my conceptual diagram. This is broken up, and you don't need to really look at this in any detail. This comes out of a paper that was written by some of my colleagues. That kind of conceptualizes how earthworm invasion occurs in yellow and what the physical effects and biological effects of those invasions might be, and then what the consequences might be. And down here is where the harm would be or benefit would be classified. So I'm going to talk about each of these in turn, and I'm going to start by talking about earthworms and earthworm invasions. So how long do you suppose European earthworms have been in the forests around here? I sure wish we knew. I don't know, maybe since 1790 or something like that. The Lumbricus rubellus, we kind of think maybe it got in here more recently, though, because it wasn't really very widely used for any purpose except as bait, and it wasn't imported around here until the 1950s. No evidence, though. There's really no evidence on when these earthworms first appeared. You know, you can imagine they came over with the pilgrims on potted plants and got released into the environment. So they've probably been with us a long time. But why aren't they in all forests? You know, so I grew up around Boston, and that was where I said you could dig holes and find worms. Some places, they're not every place. That's where the pilgrims came, right? So 1620, there's probably been earthworms in greater Boston area for 300, 400 years. Why aren't they in all forests? And that would say then, is this a phenomenon that's ongoing, that they're spreading across the landscape? Which is the impression that I always had. Now, what about those of you who work for plantations? I know there's some plantations folks here. There's this Amynthus, right, the jumping worm. So when did it appear in plantations? So that's it. It just got here. Now, this Asian worm hasn't been here for very long. And clearly, it got to plantations. And within a couple of years, all of the lower part of plantations was completely colonized by the Amynthus worm. So it very rapidly expanded throughout all the habitat that was suitable for it. And whether it's going to spread out through everywhere around here, we haven't seen it very much. I haven't seen it out in the natural forests at all. It's a hard question to answer because you have to sample the earthworm populations, which isn't easy. To get a really reliable sample, a quantitative sample, what you would have to do would be to dig a pit in the ground down a meter deep and dig all that soil out and then sift through it and look for all the earthworms you can find. You can imagine if you're trying to survey where the earthworms occur, that's not a very efficient way to do it. It takes a day to dig a pit and get all the earthworms out. So people have come up with various quick and dirty methods. This is the method that we use is the hot mustard extraction method. So in this watering can is a suspension of Coleman's hot mustard powder at the rate of 40 grams of powder per gallon of water. You mix it up, you wait about 15 minutes, you pour it on the soil, and the earthworms don't like that. And they come to the surface and the student there is with her forceps and she's going to pick them out and 30 worms will come up within 5 or 10 minutes. So you can do quite a lot of sampling with that much more efficient method. Unfortunately, you could really never do a complete job of surveying a large area using this kind of a quantitative method. It's very good for quantitative samples, but not for figuring out where the worms are and where the worms aren't. But conveniently, these two species, Lumbricus terrestris and Lumbricus rubellus, make it very obvious where there are earthworms. They create these midden piles and these casts, and they eliminate the forest floor. And so you can walk around in the woods and figure out where there are earthworms and where there aren't earthworms. So some informal observations of a committed hiker. So a lot of you have probably hiked on the Finger Lakes Trail. Did you ever notice that you see earthworms some places and you don't see them everywhere? Probably not a lot of people are looking at the ground, right? You're looking at the view. When I hike around, I look at the ground, and are there earthworms? I did that, as David said, when we were on the Appalachian Trail. I was on the Appalachian Trail with my daughter for 3 months. We didn't hike the whole thing, but when we were on the Appalachian Trail, I would always take notes about where, I have a map with where the earthworms were in the southern Appalachians and the northern Appalachians. So some anecdotal observations. You pretty much always find earthworms when you're near an agricultural field. This is just from hiking on the Appalachian Trail. You almost always find them when you're near a town. So when you come through a town, when you get close to the edge of the town, you find some earthworms. When you go by lakes or you're going along streams, you'll often find earthworms. But when you get out into the woods and up in the mountains, you don't find any earthworms. And this is pretty much true throughout the whole Appalachian Trail. Those are pretty anecdotal. We have some more formal observations. The source of these observations, so my son didn't get to go hiking on the Appalachian Trail, but I sent him out to the Arnott Forest in south of here, a 4,000-acre forest just down south of here, typical upland forest, just like our state forests. And I told him, okay, Bob, we're going hiking on the Appalachian Trail. You walk back and forth all through the Arnott Forest and figure out where the worms are and where the worms aren't by doing this, looking at the ground, seeing if there are worms. We paid him to do it, so. And so he created a map of, I think he hiked like 110 kilometers in the Arnott Forest and recorded as he went around where there were earthworms and where there weren't. So this is a map for the Arnott Forest of the distribution of earthworms. So the gray is earthworms, the white is no earthworms. So in the Arnott Forest, about a third or a little bit more than a third of the landscape has earthworms on it. Some of the areas have what he classified as, he called transition. So you know there's earthworms if there's no forest floor at all and you see casts and middens everywhere. In the transitional areas, it's clear there's been worm activity, it's either that they haven't been there very long or that there's not many worms, because there's still a little bit of organic matter on the surface, and you don't see a lot of quite as much evidence of the worm effects. So with this as a basis, we can do a quantitative analysis of what are the factors that are associated with having a high probability of finding worms, and what are the factors associated with a low probability of finding worms. So you do some statistics on it. The most obvious and most important factor, and this probably is the most important correlate world nationwide throughout the northern United States, if you're near an agricultural field, you're pretty much always going to find earthworms. And if you go to any woodlot in the farm country up north of here, every woodlot has earthworms in it. I don't think I've ever found a woodlot without earthworms. Now, that could be because the soils are good, you had agriculture on the good soils, or it could be because the agriculture has earthworms in it, and the earthworms get into the forest from those agricultural soils. Or it could be both of those things. Another factor that shows up in the data set is that if you're close to roads, and this shows up in some people, other people's data sets from the northern Midwest, if you're close to roads, you're more likely to find earthworms. And again, it's probably a matter of dispersal. That is, they're being carried by on the tires of cars or something like that, and then getting out from those roads into the woods. One that's a little more subtle that we could pick up because the topography in Arnott Forest is fairly complicated is that topography affects earthworms. So you're much more likely to find earthworms if you're in places that are a little wet. And some of you may have noticed this, and I really see this on the Finger Lakes Trail, hiking the Finger Lakes Trail, that if it's a little wet, if you're near a stream or the soil drainage is somehow a wet spot, you're much more likely to find worms than if you're up on a ridge. I think it's probably something to do with drought. And also, I told my son to keep track of what trees were growing every place where he found worms and didn't find worms. And it was clear that if you find maple, ash, basswood forest, you're much more likely to find worms than if you're in a beech hemlock forest. So somehow the tree composition is interacting with the worms in some way. Of course, the problem here is kind of a chicken and egg problem, right? Are the worms there? Is the maple, ash, basswood there because the soils are good, so that's why the worms are there? Or are the soils good so that the maple, ash, basswood is there? It's one of these chicken. It's what's the classical ecology problem. If you're a sociologist or economist, the ecology problem is the problem that you can't figure out cause and effect, because the environment affects the organisms, and the organisms affect the environment, and it's very difficult to know which is which, which comes first. Just one anecdotal observation on vegetation and tree species composition and earthworms. So probably a lot of you have hiked in the Adirondacks. You'll almost never see earthworms in the Adirondacks. And I take my class to the Adirondacks each fall, and we do a tour up Route 28 to Old Forge and then beyond up to Blue Mountain Lake. And we stop at a series of sites along the way. And one of the sites we stop in is near Eighth Lake in the Fulton Chain of Lakes, so just north of Old Forge. And it's the only place I've ever seen earthworms in the Adirondacks. And it happens to be in a place where there's a maple ash basswood forest. And the maple ash basswood forest is there because it happens to be a place where there's marble, where the soils are made of calcium, have an influence of calcium carbonate. So the soil pH is higher, the acidity in the soil is lower. So the earthworms are probably there because the soil has a high pH, and the basswood is there because the soil has a high pH. Both of those things. It could also, though, have something to do with the fact that this is right near Eighth Lake. And Eighth Lake is a campground right there, and it's a fishing hole. And so that's where the earthworms came from. And in fact, people working in other parts of the country, doesn't work at Arnott Forest because there's no fish there. But if you're near a fishing hole, you find earthworms. So we can add to our list of causative factors. If you're near a lake, a fishing hole, then you're much more likely to find worms. Why? Because fishermen have thrown out their bait, and they've spread from there into the forest. So based on these factors, we can pretty well predict when you're going to find an earthworm here or in other northern locations that didn't naturally have earthworm populations. It does still, though, leave us with this chicken and egg ecology problem. That is, the soils affect the trees, The trees affect the soil. The earthworms affect the soil. The soil affects the earthworms. And how do you know what's cause and effect? Now, in science, the only way to disentangle those kinds of complications is to do an experiment. And we happen to have, because of the foresight of some soil scientists at Cornell, the perfect setting for doing an experiment that helps us to address this question. A guy named Robert Chandler in 1939 was thinking big. This is the top of Turkey Hill up on Mount Pleasant. And there was a farm there. And Cornell bought the farm. And Professor Chandler decided to plant trees up here. 1-acre plantations in which someday, 50 years from now, people could go back and figure out how different species of trees affect the soil. So you started with a soil that was uniform, was all agriculture, it had all been plowed. It was probably crawling with earthworms. The soil had been limed and everything else. And that's what it looks like today. So after 60 or 70 years, you have a big forest that's grown up, and the soil has changed as a result of the trees influencing the soil. So if you want to go up there, it's wide open. There's a little trail in. This is Mount Pleasant Road, right at the top of Mount Pleasant Road. This is the trail that goes in, and these are a series of plantations that were planted up there, and they're still there, and we're studying them. And there are a whole bunch of different species. There are locust plantations. There are maple plantations, ash plantations, spruce, oak, pine. And they've all changed the soil in different ways. And so now we can go dig holes in the ground and see how many worms there are in the different plantations. We can pretty much probably assume that he wasn't planning to put the spruce trees in places where there weren't earthworms, right? You just put them at random on that landscape. Now there's no earthworms at all in the spruce plantations, almost no earthworms. And I don't want to bore you with the graph. The bottom line is that there's a lot, this is different plantations, and the abundance of earthworms, immatures and mature earthworms. The bottom line is that you started with this uniform slate, and now you have a situation where the number of earthworms wildly varies between the plantations because the trees have affected the soil, and maybe the trees are affecting the earthworm populations. We think that the principal thing that's going on there is the last thing I'll add to my list, which is soil pH. If you look at across the whole system, different species acidify the soil to different extent. Probably the soil was all pH 6 to begin with, but different species have acidified the soil more than others. Down here are spruce and oak, and up here are basswood and ash. And you can see that the number of earthworms is strongly related to the pH of that soil. So we can probably conclude that soil pH, the acidity of the soil, is an important factor controlling whether you have earthworms in any particular location. So why are there not earthworms everywhere in this region? Because every place isn't close to a road or close to an agricultural field or wet or with beech maple forest or near a fishing hole or with the right kind of soil. And I had always thought that it was just a matter of time. That what the worms are doing with these transition zones is marching across the landscape so that if we come back in 50 years, we're going to find a slate where every place is covered with earthworms. It's the kind of thing where we take a small snapshot in time and assuming that the time that we're studying is the most important time for this to happen. Why didn't it happen 50 years ago? Why didn't it happen 100 years ago? So it was probably naive to think that that was the case. Well, one of the reasons that we're naive about thinking that was the case was because others have noted that the earthworms are marching across the landscape. And as Don says, Amynthus got in here and it marched all the way across the plantations. So there's reasons to think that they should be marching across the landscape. And this is a study that was done in the northern Midwest where fishermen have dumped their bait near Leech Lake and the earthworms are moving out into the forest. And so they studied transects from the hot places where the earthworms have invaded out to places where the earthworms haven't invaded. And they watched it over several years, and in this complicated graph, just watch the dotted, these are different sites, watch the dotted line here. So this is what they imagine as the earthworm front, and it moves 3 meters, and it moves 3 more meters. And if we come back in 15 years, it'll have covered the whole study area. And the same they concluded for this site This one's a little bit trickier. They couldn't quite figure that one out. But and there's some studies in Canada that corroborate this kind of a pattern, that the earthworms seem to be spreading across the forest. Well, we set up transects at the Arnott Forest with this in mind about 10 years ago. So from these locations that have lots and lots of worms, 150 to 200 worms, to places where there's no worms today. And we've been studying them for years now. So this is what you see. At the worm side, there's 150, 200 earthworms per meter squared. So really, really dense populations of earthworms, no forest floor on the ground. And as you move along that transect, across the slope, at the other end, there's only a couple of worms. And it kind of fits what you might expect, that as they're invading, there are just babies that are there. So this is the percent of the earthworms that are immature or earthworms. So the immatures are going out and trying to colonize the landscape. Lots of them are immatures out at this end of the transect. So this is over 100 meters or so. And if you go out 100 meters, there's no earthworms at all, of course. So what I imagined was, this is in 2000, 2001, that we'll come back in 10 years, and it'll be a straight slate, right? That they'll have completely colonized that landscape. They move, according to other studies, 15 meters per year, crawling along the ground. Well, turns out not to be the case. So we've been studying them for 10 years now. This is a very complicated graph. I apologize for it. But on the left side in each of the panels are these places where there's 150 to 200 worms per meter squared. And at the other side is the invasion front, the farthest they've gotten into the woods. And in the middle are places that we call a transition. And what we've done is sampled a dozen times over this 10-year time span. And what we find is, just look at the line, that the earthworm populations, where there are a lot of earthworms, are stable. They jump up and down a lot from year to year. Better reproduction year, worse reproduction year, or whatever. But there's no evidence that at the invasion front or in the transition zone, the populations are increasing. They're just static. They jump up and down, but they're not invading. So for this particular part of Arnott Forest, the earthworm populations are stuck in place. Whether we'll come back in 10 years and they will advance, we don't know. But in this snapshot in time, we'd say, maybe this isn't something that's happening actively, that Lumbricus rubellus and Lumbricus terrestris are moving across the landscape. That's all I can say at this point. So we'll have to be patient and watch for another 10 or 15 years. I have to get the students out there to sample sometime. Okay. So that's enough about the invasion process. Let me go to the effects. Are the earthworms a foe? So are they a curse in the forest? What's the evidence that they have some negative consequences? We've done a series of studies at the Arnott Forest and in a few other sites around New York State to try to answer this question of what are the effects of earthworm invasion on physical, geochemical and biological phenomena in the forest, and what are the consequences for things that we value, like diversity of plants or fertility of soil or whatever. It happens that the study sites that we've chosen, some of them are dominated by this guy, Lumbricus terrestris, the anisic species. This is the one that digs the deep burrow. And some of them are dominated by this red worm, the epigeic species, Lumbricus rubellus. And so we can compare sites that have one species of worm, usually there's three or four others, but this is the dominant worm, and places that have the other dominant worm. Now, one thing to think about, the earthworms are taking that organic matter on the surface and mixing it into the soil, and in the process, they're decaying it. And this is what they do in the garden, too, right? They make humus. There was reason to think that they may have an effect on the amount of carbon in the soil. Now, why would that be a problem? So the carbon in the soil, like the carbon in the tree, if it gets oxidized to carbon dioxide, it's up in the atmosphere now, global warming. And in a typical forest, this is actually for our Harbor Brook forest, but in a typical forest, there's more carbon in the soil than there is in the trees. So if you deforest a landscape, a lot of you have probably heard, if you deforest the world, That carbon ends up in the atmosphere and it's contributing to global warming. Similarly, if earthworms invade the forest and they turn the carbon in the soil into carbon dioxide, it's the same net effect. So we were very interested to know whether earthworm invasion reduces the amount of carbon in the soil, and the answer is certainly it does. So this is for a whole series of plots, some with the red worm, some with the giant nightcrawler, and the amount of carbon in the soil is reduced about a third or half by the invasion of the earthworms. We've seen this in several different sites. So they eliminate this organic horizon, and they're also reducing the amount of total amount of carbon that's in the mineral soil, too. That carbon is now in the atmosphere, so earthworm invasions are contributing to the greenhouse effect, and to the extent that they're spreading, they're a problem. And this is something that's not trivial. It's a lot of carbon. What about fertility? Now, when you think about your garden and how fertile it is, what nutrients do you put on the soil? Nitrogen and phosphorus and potassium. Okay, I'm going to just talk about phosphorus. It's the simplest story. The nitrogen story is a real mess. Phosphorus story is pretty straightforward, and it's pretty interesting too. There was reason to think that the earthworms might have an effect on soil phosphorus. And here's what we observe, and this is comparing places with worms and without worms. If we collect the water that's passing down through the soil during a big rainstorm, so this is water that's leaching down through the soil, we can catch that water, we can grab that water with a collector and measure the chemistry of the water. And what we find is that in the middle of the root zone, 15 centimeters down, there's no difference in the phosphorus concentration between places that have worms and places that don't have earthworms. But if we go down below the root zone, down a foot and a half, 2 feet down in the ground and collect the water, we find that there's almost no phosphorus in the absence of the earthworms, whereas there's lots of phosphorus in that water down deep in the presence of the earthworms. So for some reason, the phosphorus is being carried down deep into the profile, into the streams, down into the lakes because of the invasion of the earthworms. And we've studied to some extent the mechanism whereby this is happening, but I won't go into that for tonight. So we're losing phosphorus from the soil profile as a result of earthworm invasions. So what about this curious result? If you lost a lot of phosphorus from the soil, then you should find less phosphorus in the soil, right? So this is two sites at Arnott Forest with and without earthworms, and as you might expect, there's much less phosphorus in the topsoil where the roots are in the presence of worms than in the absence of worms. So this is that effect of the previous phenomenon, leaching the phosphorus out of the soil. Almost certainly that's the cause of this decrease. So we've reduced the amount of phosphorus available to the trees by half or something like that. But wait a minute, what about these other sites? We actually find more phosphorus in the top part of the soil at site 3 and at some sites downstate in the presence of worms and in the absence of worms. And we puzzled over this for months until one of the clever students said, wait a minute, what do sites 1 and 2 have in common that's different from sites 3 in the Tompkins Farm sites? And this is when we first realized that we had an experiment in which we had different species of earthworms. Sites 1 and 2 have the red worm, the Lumbricus rubellus. Site 3 and the downstate sites have Lumbricus terrestris. So the rubellus sites have less phosphorus, the terrestris sites have more phosphorus. What's going on? So what does the terrestris do? It digs this deep burrow down in the ground, mines the soil, brings it up to the surface, and it's put 6 inches of new soil in 10 years on the screen that John Satchel had put in the ground. What it's doing is mining phosphorus-rich soil from the surface, from the depths, bringing it up to the surface and compensating for the loss that's occurring. So it's compensated by bringing up phosphorus-rich soil. How long this can go on for, eventually you're going to lose all that phosphorus from that profile, whether that'll take 100 years or 1,000 years. just a few more things about the effects on the trees. Do you want to hear about this? I'm going to tell you the story. So as I said, there's a lot of roots in that organic horizon. So they eliminate the organic horizon. They mix it all into the mineral soil, right? Now, this is a location where there's lots of recycling going on. There's lots of critters living in that horizon. And it's changed around so that now you just have mineral soil all the way through the profile. So what happens to the roots? Well, where there are worms, there's fewer roots. These are the tiny little rootlets of the trees that are involved in taking nitrogen and phosphorus up from recycling and putting it into the leaves of the trees. Fewer of those little roots because you've eliminated that horizon here, the forest floor, where most of the roots are located. And another situation where I puzzled over why this was happening, and it seems very obvious now, but we figured out what was happening as a result of some other experiments we did. We started up an experiment a couple of years ago in which we wanted to follow the food web and how the food web in the soil is affected by the earthworms. So what we did was to build chambers around little sapling trees of sugar maple. So we have about 50 little sugar maple trees inside these chambers. And we replaced the atmosphere in the chamber with a carbon dioxide isotope that we can detect. So carbon comes in carbon-12, which is most of the atmosphere. And then there's a teensy, teensy little bit of carbon-13 in the atmosphere. It's a heavy isotope of carbon. It's not radioactive, it's just heavy. And you can detect it with a scientific instrument. So we fill the atmosphere up with this heavy carbon and let the trees photosynthesize it for a few days. And so they absorb all this C13, and we can then watch it cycle through the system. So don't worry about the axis here. We're seeing an increase in the amount of C13 from the day we start to label the trees, and it goes up to this huge quantity of C13, which is very, very easy to detect. So the foliage has a lot of C13 in it. We do it right at the end of the summer. And then these leaves drop on the ground. And the experiment was to take these leaves and remove them from the chamber and bring them out into the woods and put them on plots with and without earthworms and then follow that carbon through the soil. And we've been working on this study for some years now. But just for the fun of it, I said, why don't we sample the earthworms that are inside the chamber? So we've taken all the leaves away. There is some C13 in the twigs and the wood of the trees, but they're still sitting there in the trees. The only C13 that's in the soil comes from the roots of the trees. So the tree is moving carbon down into its roots, and so the C13 in the roots increases continuously during the fall as they translocate this carbon down into the root system. So we sample the earthworms here, and what are we going to find? The earthworms have a signature that's about the same as the roots. What does that mean? So the earthworms eat the soil, but the soil doesn't have any C13 in it. They eat the leaves, but there's no leaves. We took the leaves away. So what are they eating? The earthworms are eating the roots, and I think they're eating a lot of roots. You won't find this in the literature. Earthworms apparently eat lots and lots of roots. They also eat onions, apparently. Somebody told me, I was talking about earthworms, and somebody, I can't remember who it was, said gardening, the earthworms flip over the onions. And has anybody had trouble with earthworms and their onions? Okay. Earthworms are not your friend. They're your foe. This explains why there's fewer roots in the soil with the earthworms. It's got to have a big effect on the way the system works to have the earthworms eating all these roots and the tree having to grow all these new roots all the time. So anyway, we've been studying let me go to effect. This is probably what people from plantations are most interested in. What does it do to the plants? I mean, if they're doing all this to the roots, what could it be doing to the, for example, the herbs in the forest? And there turns out not to be a whole lot of evidence on this. The anecdotal observation is that when you have earthworms in the forest, you don't have as many herbs on the ground. But anybody that's been to McGowan Woodlot knows that it's a place that's just wall-to-wall herbaceous vegetation. Is there less herbaceous vegetation now than there was 10 years ago? Well, the earthworms have probably been there for, or is it the deer that are eating there? I don't know, but the anecdotal observation is that the earthworms seem to have an effect on some of the herbs. And the reason, there's reason to expect that to be the case, because the herbs have seeds that germinate in that organic horizon, and if you change around that germination environment, you're probably going to change around the habitat for the herbs. There's been a few studies of this. They reach some pretty consistent conclusions that there are some forest herbs that benefit from having earthworms. So if you like Jack in the Pulpit, or you like wood sedges, or you like false Solomon seal, then you're happy because the earthworms seem to promote the reproduction and the abundance of those herbs. Whereas in contrast, there are some very attractive herbs that are clearly harmed by earthworm invasions, including Aralia and Uvularia and Polygonatum and Streptopus. So all typical woodland herbs that grow on those organic, that require those organic horizons for their successful reproduction. Exactly what's going on still needs some working out. Because there may be some interactions going on with deer, and I'm not quite sure the whole story, how the whole story is going to come down in the end. That's some superficial couple of studies that have been done on this conclude this. And I want to finish with a little bit of a tale about the about the soil food web. So what we've been studying in this project where we're doing the labeling with the isotope, litter labeling with the isotope, is trying to study what the effects of the earthworms are on the soil food web, which is this extremely complex who eats whom type of a system, with thousands of different species eating one another. And now we throw the earthworms into the mix. Now, in the natural situation, you have lots of creatures that live in that thick organic horizon, things like springtails, carabid beetles, really scary mites. Actually, this is a millimeter, so you don't have to worry too much about the scary mite, but dozens and dozens of species of mites, species of millipedes and centipedes and spiders and so on. Very, very diverse below-ground community there. At the top of the food web in these woodlands is the charismatic megafauna of the soil food web, which is the woodland salamanders. So woodland salamanders eat all those creatures, and they crawl around through that organic horizon and eat the springtails and eat the mites and eat the beetles. And what are they going to do? What's the redback salamander going to do when there's no organic horizon there anymore? What's it going to eat? Now, one thing it could do is turn to earthworms, right? This is actually a spotted something, I don't know. But they do eat earthworms. Just if you're going to remember anything from this talk, you'll remember one amazing fact about salamanders. If you add up the weight of all the vertebrates in the forest, the birds, the deer, the rabbits, the rodents, the raccoons, and so on, you add up the weight of all those organisms, there's more weight of this one species, the redback salamander, than all those put together. So redback salamanders are the dominant organism of the top predator in the woodland food chain, soil food chain. They're really, really abundant. There's 10 of them per meter squared. And they're eating all this stuff that's in the organic horizon. Maybe they'll turn to worms. Now, a study done by some of my colleagues in natural resources, Bernd Blasi and his group in natural resources, suggests that the salamanders may be at some risk because of earthworm invasions. And this is a little bit complicated, but on this axis is earthworm biomass, so more earthworms to the right, and the earthworms eat the litter, so less litter when you have earthworms. They're consuming that litter. If there's less litter, what happens to the salamanders? salamander populations seem to go down. What John Mertz thinks is that there's a sort of a life history trap here. The salamanders can eat the worms, but the salamanders, when they're little babies, the earthworms are these gigantic things compared with them, and so they can't eat them when they're babies. And so they have a problem with their life history. You know, they'd normally be able to eat the springtails and the teensy little creatures, and those creatures aren't there anymore. The evidence, though, is mixed, and we may revise this story in the near future. It seems like they're doing pretty good in some of our sites, the salamanders. Okay, so what does this say? What do we say to Darwin? Oh, what do we say about Amynthus? This is the jumping worm. This is the one that's invading. Is this an evil worm?
Totally.
There's no question. Amynthus is the epitome of evil. So what do you say to Darwin? I don't know if I'd say to Darwin that you know, in the history of the world, there's nothing as bad as invasive earthworms, but they don't have positive effects as far as I'm concerned. They're converting carbon in the soil into atmospheric CO2 and promoting greenhouse effect. They're eating roots of the trees. They're probably affecting the productivity of the forest. They're probably eventually affecting the health of the forest. They seem to be affecting herbs. They seem to have some effects on salamanders. I think the weight of the evidence would be that they're more of a curse than they are a blessing when they're in the forest. And so by definition, we'll call them an invasive species, at least these 12 species that have these negative effects. So I'm happy to answer any questions if people have them, but you have to ask questions that have nothing to do with earthworms because I don't know very much about earthworms. I'm a root guy. Thanks.